year and next year, working with local writers and working with the advanced writing program and even with our students occasionally. I'm told that they should have met before now. They were at Cambridge, although I'm not supposed to mention that together, but they were at different colleges and vaguely knew each other. Maggie O'Farrell, who was born in Northern Ireland and grew up in Wales and Scotland and has also spent some time in the Far East, is the author of After You'd Gone, which came out in April to wonderful reviews, and she's now just about to finish another novel, which is apparently called...
At the moment called
My Lover's Lover, and if you don't like that title, it may change, so you should tell her you like it, because I like it. Candida Clark is the author of The Last Look, which came out in 1998, and The Constant Eye, which came out earlier this year. And she's just finished a new novel, which has also never been announced to the public before. And so this is, you're hearing the title for the first time, The Ceremony of Innocence. Both Maggie and Candida have worked and continue to work for many London newspapers, and now are, unlike me, happily working for them less so that they can spend more time with fiction, and you'll hear in a moment why they should continue this. I'll pass over to Maggie and then to Candida. Thank you.
Well, my book kind of skips about in the life of a woman called Alice. And the first bit I'm going to read you is a bit when she's about 18, and she's gone home, taking home a boyfriend for the first time who hasn't really gone down very well with the family. The sun is burning off the mist, revealing the snaggled rocks that rear up at intervals along the sand. On the beach is an odd, broken assortment of my family. My older sister is away at college with a man she will eventually marry. My grandmother is off visiting friends in Glasgow, and Mario is with us. My family have accepted his arrival with unexpected and unprecedented equanimity, and here we all are, playing happy families on Gullen Beach. My mother has nested herself down beside a rock with a Scotland on Sunday, keeping the water that the sand holds from seeping into her skirt. Arranged around her are a black snakeskin handbag, her shoes, laces tucked in under the tongue, my father's book on seashore birds, and a number of white plastic boxes protecting the picnic Beth and I made earlier. Beside her, in a deck chair, my father sleeps with his mouth open. Beth is twisting her hair into silky flaxen coils and snipping off her split ends with nail scissors from my mother's handbag. The scissors flash with light, and she gives Mario long sideways glances as he resolutely chews his way through sandwiches he picks from the boxes by my mother. He eats with a concentrated seriousness, his jaws slapping open and snapping closed. He's not speaking. His eyes scan the slowly appearing horizon. In about 2 hours' time, I will tell him that I don't ever want to see him again, and he will return to America. But we don't know this yet. For the moment, there is only the beach and the gulls going shree, shree over our heads. My father wakes and starts asking my mother what time it is. She ignores him, and he reaches for the paper instead, crushing its pages into a methodical square before reading it. "Have you had enough to eat, Mario?" my mother asks, in a way so barbed it makes me look up. His name puzzles her. She can't say it without frowning. He nods with a mouthful of food and gives her a thumbs up. Beth titters. I stand up. "Shall we go for a swim?" I ask Beth. She jumps to her feet and helps me unzip the back of my dress. We begin struggling out of our clothes and flinging them into an untidy heap. We have our bathing costumes on underneath. Mine is black and hers is white with blue stripes. I readjust the straps, pinging the elastic into place against my skin, and I turn round, racy to the sea. We run together towards the sea, leaving Mario behind with my parents. The hard ridges of sand push up painfully into the soft parts of my feet. Behind me, Beth shouts at me to slow down. I stop short at the sea edge, stunned, panting. It is full of jellyfish, their viscous bodies palpitating like breathing hearts, their fringed tendrils ready to hook and sting. There is not a square foot of the water that does not contain a shivering mass of clammy glue, and it seems malevolent, as if these creatures have spontaneously generated from its elements. I'm not going in there with them, Beth says, and pokes at one with a stick. It convulses in shock, draws in its threads, and shoots itself away with surprising speed. I clutch her and pretend to push her in. She screams and wriggles, laughing, and I am momentarily blinded by her hair, which streams into my face in the wind. We align our stomachs in a shallow pool, our feet cutting swathes in the sand. I rest my chin on my knuckles. Final swirls of fog roll slowly up the beach. Beth twirls her hair and whistles. I am conscious of something pressing on me that I want to say to her, but when I open my mouth to speak, I realize that I don't know what it is. A dog passes, red rag tongue lolling from its mouth. He eyeballs us briefly, but lollops on, too busy to stop. You who? Our mother's voice reaches us through the cries of the birds. I turn my neck and look under the crook of my arm to see her running in the way only women of her age can, awkwardly modest, with her knees together as if she'd rather be walking. She's brandishing a camera. Beth and I smile dutifully into the sun as the shutter clicks. My father joins us hastily, not wishing to be left alone with Mario. Mario trails behind. He has taken off his shirt. His chest is tanned and he flexes his arm muscles. If I keep him out of the edges of my vision, I can almost pretend he isn't here. At the top of the beach, my mother's newspaper wheels across the sand. Are you going swimming or not? He looks at me hard. I stand up. My costume is damp, cold, and crusted with sand. There are too many jellyfish, Beth tells him. Mario closes his hand around my wrist and runs towards the sea, dragging me behind him, my wrist bones cracking and bending under the pressure. Spumes of water spray up under my flailing legs. The jellyfish are swirled about in the agitated water, and I hear a screaming that isn't the seagull's. He stops dead, icy water lapping at my ribcage, and, placing his hands on my shoulders, he forces me down. My knees buckle and water closes over my head. I twist and thrash under his grasp, lashing out at him, swallowing great gulps of bitter water. My skin is prickling, alert with a panic of sensing the stinging brush of jellyfish trails. Through his fingers, I can feel the shudder of his laughter. Suddenly, I'm released. My head soars and breaks the surface, and sunlight rushes in on me. The sound of the beach roars in my ears, and I gasp for air, gagging and coughing. I wipe the water away from my eyes with shaking hands, and we stare at each other for a split second before I am pushed down again into the silence of the sea. This time I keep my mouth closed. The water is swinging with light. His fingers are pressing small, circular bruises into my shoulders. The jellyfish hang in clusters just below the surface like parachutes. Beyond them, I can make out the figures of my parents, distant and blurred, standing at the shore. The next bit is... Well, the only thing you should know, really, that Anne is Alice's mother, the girl you just heard there. And Elspeth is Alice's grandmother, who's Anne's mother-in-law, if that makes any sense. And they all live in the same house. Anne fills the sink. The water flashes and throws icy dart of light up to the ceiling. It is a clear, bright, crisp afternoon, the best weather for North Berwick. She might go down to the beach later on, where the wind will be freezing and scalpel sharp. From the window, the island of Craig Leith is defined clearly against the navy blue sea. The sea is Anne's weather vane. She can see it from practically wherever she is in the house. Its colour and texture change by the hour. It can be anything from a forbidding Air Force blue on stormy days to a deep green on cloudless August days. She doesn't hold with forecasts, although she does find a certain rhythmic calm in listening to the shipping forecasts. Years ago, Ben, thinking she'd be interested, bought her a map of all the places, Faroes, Fair Isle, Norfolkshire, Fisher, Forties, Cromarty. He hadn't understood that she didn't care where they were, and why on earth would she, for heaven's sake? But it was precisely because it was meaningless to her that she enjoyed it. Anne sighs. She'd pinned up the map so as not to hurt his feelings, of course. Then one of the girls had torn it when flouncing out the back door in a teenage tantrum. Probably Alice. In fact, it was definitely Alice. Anne had been secretly glad that she could take it down, folding it into itself so that the Northern Hebrides gently kissed the Isle of Wight, jagged coastlines rubbing up against each other in the rubbish bin. A sudden crash from the room above makes her jump. She looks up at the ceiling, listening out for Elspeth's footsteps. The moment stretches, her hand in the cooling water in the sink. Nothing. Elspeth? Her voice sounds strident, still unmistakably English after all these years. Elspeth, are you there? Anne wipes her hand on a flowered dish towel and goes through the sitting room and up the stairs. The door to Elspeth's room is shut. Excuse me. Elspeth has kept on living in the front bedroom and feels periodically irked by this. The room she and Ben have had since they were married is smaller and faces Marmion Road. If you leant out of the side window, then you could admittedly see a square patch of sea, but it was nothing like the long line of horizon, broken only by the jutting rocks of Craigleith and Fidra, that dominated the whole of one side of Elspeth's room. My view, as Elspeth rather unnecessarily referred to it. Anne taps at the door with her nails. Elspeth, are you all right? Her voice quavers a little. She presses down the handle. Elspeth is lying stretched out on the carpet, one hand flung above her head. Her body forms a perfect parallel to the line of the horizon, which, Anne notes, is beginning to darken. Anne lets go of the door handle, which springs back with a loud ping, walks over and stands above Elspeth. Her face is grey, twisted. The position her body has fallen in is an oddly seductive, starlet pose, one arm above her head, the other draped over her chest, her legs drawn up. Anne bends over at the waist. There is no sign of any breathing at all. She straightens up and tiptoes back across the room. Halfway, she wonders why she's tiptoeing. She leaves the door open deliberately and goes back down the stairs. In the kitchen, she empties muddied potatoes from a brown paper sack into the sink. They fall against each other in the water and the soil dissolves slowly, sinking into a gritty sediment at the bottom. When a pile of wet peelings has developed at her side, she realises that she won't be needing as many potatoes as she thought she would, but doesn't stop peeling. Later, she hears Ben come in and shout hello. He treads upstairs and she hears the lavatory flush, the water rushing through the house, him going into their bedroom. She's never realised before how heavily he walks. She waits, listening, her hand resting on the draining board. There is a short silence. She picks at a loose jag in her thumbnail, reaches for an emery board, but puts it back. Then Ben shouts her name 3 times, and she waits, turning her head to the doorway, arranging her face into an expression of wide-eyed concern. Just so you don't think this book is the most depressing thing you've ever read, I'm going to read you one more bit, a very short bit. First, I'm going to drink some water. This is a bit when Alice is a bit older. She's kind of in her mid-20s now. And she's done an interview about the place she works for with a journalist called John. It's gone rather well. 2 days later, Alice answered the office intercom in the middle of the morning. I'm here to see Alice Rakes. The line crackled and the sound of traffic in a street came booming down the line. She couldn't place the voice. Who is it? My name is John Friedman. She slammed down a handset at once. Oh, shit. Everyone in the office looked up. Then she pressed the button to let him in. Oh, shit, shit. She tore open her bag and seized her hairbrush and began sweeping it through her hair in long, urgent strokes. Who on earth is it? Susanna shouted across the office. Anthony, the director, appeared out of his room. What's going on? He asked. Why is Alice running around? Oh God, don't ask. What am I going to do? How do I look? Alice appealed to Susanna. Completely mad. She galloped down the first flight of stairs and then slowed her pace so as not to appear red in the face and panting when she saw him. He was standing at the bottom of the stairs reading one of the literacy posters stuck on the wall. Hello. He turned and smiled as if he'd been caught doing something wrong. She tried to ignore her stomach, which was trying to cram itself up into her throat. Hi, she said, leaning in what she hoped was a casual manner on the banister. What are you doing here? Did you forget to ask me something for the interview? He shook his head. Did you read the book? No, not yet. There was an agonizing pause. She fiddled with her hair and put a strand of it into her mouth. I was just passing through Covent Garden and... He stopped, sighed and cast his eyes up at the ceiling. Then he looked at her and said, I think we both know that's a lie. A curious thing happened to Alice's face. The muscles around her mouth, the ones that controlled her smile, appeared to go into spasm, and she had to bite her lips so as not to appear to be grinning in a really brainless way. She looked at the floor. A taxi rumbled past outside. He rubbed his hand against the weft of his stubble. You have to come and see a film with me tonight. Her smile disappeared immediately. What do you mean I have to? Aren't you supposed to say things like please and would you like to? No, why should I? Well, it's perfectly obvious to me that you're a witch and you've put some evil spell on me. He came towards her. Oh my God, was he going to kiss her right here? She panicked and backed into a stand holding poetry competition leaflets. He came so close that she could feel the sweep of his breath on her neck. She forced herself to hold his gaze without smiling. "I love it when you're angry," he whispered. Her laughter burst out of her like water from a dam, and she thumped him hard on the chest. "You are the most infuriating man I have ever met. I would never go to the cinema with you, never. Not even if... She floundered for the most outrageously hurtful situation. "Not even if it was my favourite film playing for the last time ever, and you had the last spare ticket, not even then." John rubbed his chest where she'd hit him. "Every time I see you, I get injured. But I'm optimistic. Not even a witch can do much damage in a cinema." "I'm not coming," she shouted. "Yes, you are," he shouted back. "I'm not. I'd never go anywhere with you. Thanks."
This is also midway through a story, and this is basically a story about a male writer who uses all life as if it were just fiction, and he does the same with his wife, who he's sort of talking to and playing with a game with when you meet him here, and he's talking to her on the Eurostar and they're on the way to Paris. You see, it was a bit like this, is how I begin. It's not much, so don't expect anything spectacular from it. I didn't meet the Queen or get the Nobel Prize or anything flashy. It was just a girl once, and not that long ago either, about 4 years, though it feels further away than that now. It's like that with extreme happiness, don't you find? Once it's over, you can't even begin to see how it could have been you, really you, acting that way and feeling those things. But this all comes later, first the girl. It was simple, really. I met her by chance in the street. She asked me the way somewhere. The pavements were glowing. It was early spring and we were in the city. She just walked up to me before I'd taken in anything more about her than the fact that she was lovely, nothing more than that. Because at the time, I was preoccupied with a story I was working on and couldn't get enough space in my head freed up for girls. That's often how it is. Everything else falls away like you're wearing blinkers. But the way she said, "Is this the way to such and such?" intrigued me. She meant much more than that, I could tell. Only she didn't know how to say it. So she asked me directions to some place in town, a cinema, I think. She said she was going to go to the movies later on with a friend. Anyway, I told her where she wanted to go, thinking fast while I was telling her, drawing out the directions, which in truth were very simple. But you see, I wanted to keep her around now that I had got her there, engaged in conversation. So I embellished the directions as much as I could while I worked out a plan, and she stood there in front of me, listening to what I was telling her. But her eyes didn't meet mine, not one bit of it. They stuck like magnets to my lips. It drove me wild, watching her, watching my lips, like she was deaf, maybe, or fixated with the way I moved my mouth around the words. Shameless was how it looked. I flatter myself. It was probably just her habit. In fact, I'm sure it was just her habit, as I discovered later. Her eyes fixed on my lips somehow draw me towards her own, which are moving minutely, following the pattern of what I'm saying. As you can imagine, we must have looked pretty strange under close scrutiny, both of us barely met, but gawping like maniacs at one another's mouths. The point is that I stop giving her directions and say, "Are you really in a big hurry to get to the cinema, or can I take you out for a drink? I know a place right around the corner, let's go there." At this point, she quits staring at my lips and just stands there, smiling at me. Suddenly, I realize that until that moment, she'd had an expression of anxiety written all over her face, only I hadn't noticed it until it went away. Because as soon as the anxiety is gone, her face is lit up with such radiance that I almost fall over backwards with the shock of it. Joy, pure joy, blasted right across her face. That smile. It fills me up with an overwhelming urge to try to make her stay that way, lit up like that, in the street in front of me. I want to start pointing at her and yelling at the people who are passing by, oblivious. It's a busy street. I want to yell at them, "Did you see that? Did you see it? It was amazing." I look up at the sky real quick to see if maybe the sun just came out from the clouds, because I can't believe the way her entire aspect changed like that. But there's nothing, only the hot white clouds, the sun hidden way back behind them where I can't see it. Anyway, I have to get hold of her somehow, so I take her arm, trying to look like I'm being merely chivalrous, getting a lovely shivering sensation of heat as she nestles her elbow up against me, her bare forearms against the thin cotton of my shirt, touching me lightly. And off we go, arm in arm, to a place I know nearby, a bar with a garden in the back, where you can sit outside in the sunshine, beneath a big dusty tree and drink cold beer on a perfect summer afternoon. That was it, the start of my happiness. We sat outside together, stayed there for the whole afternoon. I memorized every little bit of her that I could lay my eyes on. I couldn't believe my luck. When I went in to get us drinks, I was like a madman, barging people out of the way and then almost tiptoeing back out, because I couldn't believe she was real, or that if she was real, that she'd still be there when I got back. But there she was, sitting on the wall beneath the tree, swinging her legs like a kid, her plain white cotton dress making her look like she'd just got out of bed almost, the thin cotton of it, all creased up around her knees, slender knees, the size of my elbows, more or less, and one of her shoes dangling on her little foot like a promise. She had long hair, pale in the sunlight, as though all the colour had been washed out of it, reflecting the white heat like a sheet of unmelting ice, dead straight and smooth to touch too, which I did secretly at one point when she leaned past me and the sweep of it curtained across the naked skin of my face like a caress. Her body was tiny and she had strong hands, skinny fingers but with strength in them like a musician's, big eyes, a dark golden colour, like burning metal. Her eyes worried me. They were too sad for someone so lovely, but they intrigued me, and I knew that I would have to keep seeing her. So we sat there talking about places we'd been to and would like to go to in the future, the thoughts together hanging there like a silk sash to bind us. It was perfect, not ideal perfect, I'm not crazy, just a wonderful time. And the thing is, it went on for years. We even got married. I was happy. I was very happy. You wanted to know about a time I was happy. Well, that was it. The girl still has her hands in mine and is looking down at them while I stop speaking. The next part, she says, I mean, what made you really happy about her? What was it actually? Oh, it was any number of things, I say, feeling the warm sweat seep between our pressed flesh, liking it, remembering. Anyway, I go on, that's not the end of it, not by a long shot. The happiness, the particular kind of happiness that I had with her, got lodged inside of me, so I couldn't get rid of it, even if I wanted to. It was a gift. I was grateful. I wanted to thank someone, but didn't know who to thank, so I thanked her. I was grateful to her. I loved her so much. I was grateful for the happiness. It was entirely because of her. I thought that without it, I was nothing, and I put everything into making sure that I held it there, inside me, where I knew I could keep it safe. The thing was that when I tried to write about it, to give her something back, like offering her a gift in return to explain how I felt about her and about how happy she made me, it was impossible. I couldn't write about it. Or more to the point, as soon as I wrote about it, I killed it. Thinking about her with all those dirty words nestled up against her, straight away turned her into someone else. I knew what I was doing and I went right on and did it. I watched her drowning with my words wrapped around her ankles, pulling her under. I was caught. But I didn't know what else to do to keep her. It was the reason for marrying her, to make something separate of ourselves that would last beyond the fading bodies. I had to make our attachment real and give it a life of its own so that it could live on without us once we'd given up believing it was possible, because I knew we would, just as I knew she'd leave me sooner or later, and I couldn't bear to sit around doing nothing, just waiting for that to happen. I had to do something. So I scrutinized her. I was attentive to everything, and told myself that that was all I was doing, was watching and recording, no more than that. And soon enough, instead of seeing her loveliness, I saw the monster. I knew that like me, she was someone equally isolated by the foul, stinking life carried around inside herself, swamped for a time by happiness, but in the end, the stubborn life still there, bubbling away like a sewer, reminding her, me, of itself, just when we thought it had gone. Writing her into stories, at once I saw other men's hands upon her body, eyes jellying their way across her face and lingering between her thighs like encouraged fingers. I felt gentle scratches that I wondered where she'd learnt. Not from me, I was sure, not from me. Not the way she scratched my back one night. It happened suddenly and then I saw it. Not at the time, but the next day when I sat down to write. I suddenly saw it. I saw it all. It was as though someone had scraped the thin layer of devotion off my eyeballs and there she was, hiding behind it, with countless other men crashing into her whore cunt, welcomed by her flailing thighs, grappling about their backs like muscular snakes. I couldn't go into the street with her anymore. I couldn't bear to see the men's eyes upon her. I couldn't stand to see them brush past her, their bodies slightly taller than hers, so that horizontal they'd be fit to fuck, and there'd be nothing I could do to stop that match of limb to limb, just watch, crouched in the darkness, counting the sweat drops flying as they fucked her to tears. So I watched. I watched her like a hawk, I can tell you. She was never out of my sight. I knew that I'd catch the deceitful moment and then I'd have her back inside me, the happiness and the shit of it all fitting perfectly, as it should, because at last I was seeing the truth of it. Anyway, then she got ill. We'd been about to have children. It hadn't worked. She had to go away. There was never anything I could have done to help her. I had only wanted to make her mine, hold on to her in some way. But I was certain of her infidelities, as certain of them as I've ever been of anything. Whose dead babies, were those dead babies even mine? And her autonomy was too resilient. It taunted me and made me jealous. I resented the fact that she was perpetually separate from me, so I was glad that she went. That's the God's honest truth. I'd been living in a state of panic for too long. I thought I'd go crazy with it, panic and watching. My eyes hurt with it. My heart ached. I spent entire dark days certain of only one thing, that I was certain of nothing. I had no answers anymore. It unsettled me. So she went away, and that was that. I visited the place once. It was hard for me. I'd intended to go there often to see how she was, check that she was being looked after. But in the end, when I went there, I got sidetracked, talking to some doctor or other who'd been treating her. I remember walking outside on the lawn with him. I asked him to tell me how things were done there, and so he was keen to tell me everything, not just about my wife. So I was strolling around with him, taking it all in, not missing a thing, when suddenly I saw myself through her eyes. In fact, it actually felt as though she were watching me, her eyes upon me. I remember looking around, half expecting her to see her jumping out at me from behind a tree. It scared the hell out of me. I knew that she would see my excitement as I got hold of these new ideas, and that was the problem. Even in her worst moments of suffering, my first instincts were always and only to look harder. I mean, what was I doing there if I wasn't gathering material for some tale or other? So once I'd heard all I wanted to hear, I got out of there as fast as I could, and I didn't look back. Now I'm aware of her hands again, pressing into mine as though I've just reminded her of something. She's not looking at me, so I can't see her expression, but anyway, I know what it will be. The eyes like two dead reproaches, overfull with things I can't even begin to affect. Like wanting to change the plot in a book written 2,000 years ago, when all you can do is sit there, cantered over in the margins, numb with the impotence of it all. Naturally, I don't look at her eyes, don't even begin to want to. Instead, I lift my hands out from hers, which cling helplessly as I move away, pretending I need to brush the hair from my forehead. It's short hair, who am I kidding? I turn to look out of the window, knowing I can't look at her, even made uncomfortable by her reflection, not wanting to see her sweet, smiling face, her eager, bunching shoulders, nor her hot metal golden eyes matching the slam of the tequila light still smashing serenely past us in the lousy black tunnel. Not wanting to see any of this, nor her delicate swinging ankle carefree turning, reminding me, nor her little wrists waiting for me to take them once more in my hands and just keep them held there so that they can be still. I can't anymore, can't do any of this, I'm thinking. The thoughts spinning about like a pathetic leaf set on fire in my brain, singeing it from the inside out, the pain just getting worse. And I wish there was something somewhere in this rotten earth that could douse it out. But of course there isn't. What was I thinking of? Telling her a fucking story about my ever having been happy. What was I thinking? What was I hoping for? Jesus Christ. I shut my eyes, cooling off my sweating eyeballs as best I can, keeping them shut, tight shut against the black tunnel. Disturbed from this eye silence, only when I hear her go, oh, a delicate sound, little more than a soft exhalation of warm breath. Look, she says, we're out of the tunnel. I open my eyes, and she's right. We are. I can't deny it.
We'll include everybody else in our conversation for now. There are some similarities. Yes. The last time I heard you speak, Maggie, you said something to the effect that you were interested in the monstrous and the everyday, the frightening and the everyday, and I think it's something that actually applies to the both of your work. And I was interested in hearing from both of you about that.
Well, in terms of my work, because I can't speak for Candida's, I think some of the books that I really like are the kind of 19th century Gothic horror, things like Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner, and Frankenstein I really like, and Dracula's pretty cool too. And I think what I'm really interested in, in my own writing, is taking that kind of fear and horror and loathing and kind of putting it into a domestic context. It's probably what I was saying when I was last talking to you about it. I think that's when the fear is most effective somehow. I think that's why I really like James Hogg's book, Confession Justified Sinner, because the kind of, because there aren't any vampires or ghosts or apparitions. It's all kind of, all the fear is kind of within the family and within your domestic environment, which I think is kind of far more frightening, really.
Yeah. Does that make any sense to you? Is that what you're interested in?
Yeah, I mean, specifically with this particular book, I was really, it sounds probably, that, especially that reading, probably sounds quite, maybe it sounds quite extreme, but what I wanted to do is sort of take almost to a logical conclusion the way some writers in the past, I don't know, Graham Greene type writers, very specifically use real life very directly as a, you know, cipher it straight into fiction. Mm. And I think this is probably a very, I think it's probably a very male thing to do. So I was kind of looking at the idea of taking, you know, because he basically sort of wrecks his wife's life, drives her mad, And so I just wanted to take that to its logical conclusion. What would actually happen if a writer were to use real life very literally?
But very step by step.
Yeah, so it's very step by step, sort of an anatomy of how that process works on her real life, how that then filters back into his writing and vice versa. And so definitely the horror of the everyday.
Yeah,
because
he must
the
have met my ex-husband, yes. as soon as I wrote about it, I killed it. That was...
Yeah.
Does that idea frighten you? Is that how you feel about about fiction yourself? Or is it that just very much in the character?
No, but I think that's the essential, you know, if without sounding too grand, I think that has to be the essential paradox of words, is that obviously they are never going to attach themselves to the fact of what it is you're trying to describe.
Yeah.
They're always going to be running after it or leading it or something, but they're never going to be actually in the moment of the moment that you're feeling or you're attempting to describe.
Yeah.
And so this is his, he's a kind of wicked man, there's no two ways about it, but his dilemma, the only point of sympathy you could ever have for this character is that what he's trying to do, you know, when he's trying to convey this happiness he feels, it's instantly killed off because it's just, what is it, just scratches on a page, little black marks, and the happiness he felt, you know, with his wife in the early stages was a thing apart from the actual language he used to describe it.
Yeah.
So I think that's just the paradox of writing, is that you're never going to be able to, you know, pin the thing itself, are you? So he's faced with that.
The male point of view, did you, how was that writing for you? Did it come naturally, or did you enjoy the...
It's I think, you know, as a sort of, you know, female writer writing now, naturally you're going to look around for your heroes or heroines in literary terms. And one of the sort of the sort of ghosts I wanted to lay to rest in a way is the idea of, I mean, it's sort of, you know, the male canon, you know, to actually look inside that voice and see what was underneath a lot of male writers.
Yeah.
And
not a pretty theory.
But that's this particular writer, so
yeah.
I'm not a neighbour.
But going back to the question of using material from life, which is what most writers end up doing in one way or another, you know, the trickiness of it, that's the first passage that you read sounds like something that really happened. Maybe it didn't, but if it didn't, how did you make it sound that way, and if it did, how did you dare to write about it and survive?
Actually, it's one of the few things in my book which is based on something that happened. I did have a very aggressive American boyfriend who tried to drown me in front of my parents. But that's another story.
Jellyfish as well?
Yeah, loads of jellyfish. It's very spooky. But I think a lot of fiction, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think a lot of fiction does start with a kind of kernel or a shell of truth. You know, I think that's how most fiction starts. It starts in fact, but I think by the time that you've kind of reimagined it and reimagined it happening to something else, and actually I put it in a different location than it really happened, and by the time you've, I mean, you know what it's like writing a novel, you have to read it 45 times and you have to redraft it, and
yeah,
but so by the time it actually appears on the page and you're reading it, it's so completely, it's gone through such a long process, it doesn't seem related.
But
and it's very, cause
I would say in my experience that if you're using something that's terrifying, very, very personal, it's at the center of your book, that in order to write about it in fiction, there has to be something in the fiction part which is very, very different from what...
Yeah, possibly.
Maybe not the particular scene by scene, but the conception of a novel. What would you say was the sort of the kernel of this novel? Was it that scene, or...?
No, the kind of the novel is that the girl it's all told that she's in a coma right at the beginning. She has an accident and she is in a coma. And so actually the whole book is sort of in real time. It's about 2 days when she's unconscious. And that was kind of the idea I wanted. I was quite interested. I'm quite interested in the idea of absence of presence, the idea that someone is there but actually not there. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of a coma really appealed to me. And also you can play around. It gives you a lot of freedom in terms of flashbacks and all that kind of stuff. You can kind of do what you like.
Yeah.
Because no one really knows much about comas. So yeah, so that's what it was. But it was quite an early scene that I wrote. But I think, I think it does, I think a lot of it is based on real life, but there's an awful lot which is made up. Yeah. I've got a sister actually who's very literal minded, doesn't read very much, and she read my book and she insisted on referring to the main character as you. And I kept saying, it's not me, it's not me. And she got very annoyed in that scene because she said that she never had a swimming costume that was blue and white. Hers was green or something. Yeah. So it's like I'm trying to explain that to somebody.
Now, there's a tremendous amount of power in your narrator's voice, but I'm not sure how you feel about him or whether your feelings about him changed as you were writing from that point of view.
Well, I mean, the book as a whole is sort of a defeat of his position.
That's good.
How it should be. Basically, sort of, to hell with, I give the ending away, but basically, the ending is, me, the writer, coming out and saying that, well, he wouldn't have, he actually didn't like the ending, because the ending is where she escapes from him in a particular way, and it's a pretty kind of drastic way. But the point being that I think, if this monstrous character that he is using his life so literally, destroying it in that way, mm-hmm. What he can't bargain on is when real life just is real and carries on and it goes its own way. Mm-hmm. So he can't actually manipulate fiction to the nth degree. He can only do it to certain points. So it's sort of a defeat of his voice, in a way.
Okay, final question to both of you. What is it like to get so close to the horror? Yes? What is it? Well, you raised it. Did you feel better writing it, or did you feel possessed?
Did you get possessed
by the voice, or possessed by the
predicament? I was working full time most of the time I wrote it. So, and I was doing quite a lot of the time. I was doing a really boring job. I was editing TV listenings, which is actually one of the worst jobs you can do in journalism. I don't know if you've ever done it. But actually it was quite beneficial because I could spend all day doing this job, which uses about that much of my brain, and then you'd just be kind of daydreaming about what you were going to write. So then I'd rush home at 6:30 and start writing. So I think I probably was a bit possessed, actually.
Yeah.
No, definitely. But it was a good thing. It got me out of the boredom of TV listings.
Yeah.
I would never do it again. It was... Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was. But I mean, I think that's very much a question of, at what point do you actually give, in exploring something that you find horrifying?
Yeah.
At what point do you actually have to stand back and say, it's not a good idea to give voice to something you think is horrible, as I think he is as a character. And I think probably, if I could do it again, I probably wouldn't have written the book, but
it's done. There's something in the way that you talk about it makes it sound as if it was necessary.
But I think it's probably necessary.
Yeah. Point. Yeah. Okay. Well, take some questions from the audience now. I'm happy to go on babbling forever. No questions at all? No, you must have a question. David, I know you have a question.
asking the question, as a poet, to fellow poets, do you have a secret and a scientific line as poets, both in the written and published poets? Are you still writing poets, and how does that inform your work now as fiction writers?
Do you want to go first?
I am in no position to speak as a poet, No. but I find often it seems to be a real condensation of a massive idea, and often it can be a real jettisoning of an idea that might have been something in the past that might have spawned something longer. But it's actually a quite an interesting outlet actually to do a sort of condensed poetic output of something. It's actually, in some ways, it's quite a good thing to do alongside, because I think otherwise you can often You know, is this somebody thinking about longer fiction? You can actually often end up, you know, having endless ideas for books in you know, notebooks. You have about sort of 10 ideas maybe at once of something you might pursue, and it's quite strange the way sort of poetry does seem to be a very sort of zippy alchemy just to get rid of something that otherwise you might spend too much time on. That's how it works for me.
I find it completely antithetical, actually. I find that when I'm writing fiction, I can't write poetry. Like, I've been finishing my second book for the past 6 months, and I haven't written poetry for most of the year, actually, just because I kind of find they use different muscles, really, and I can't do both at once. They just seem... they're all kind of as different as writing and, I don't know, TV listings, for example. No, not as boring, hopefully. But no, I find I can't do both at once at all. They're just very different things for me. But I hope to go back to it when I've got this one out of the way.
Could you write poetry when you were starting this novel? Or
was it
at a certain point that the novel took over?
I was, yeah. I was kind of writing kind of two at the same, both at the same time, and suddenly the poetry just disappeared because I had to concentrate on the novel.
Yeah, or it had to concentrate on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the ways. Yeah. One of the experiments.
Yes? Has everybody heard that question?
Okay.
Is it me?
Go ahead. Is this to me or
both?
Both, yeah. Sorry.
Sorry,
that was terrible. I haven't expected. In the case of this book, it was actually a voice that my first novel, it sort of existed in there, and it was something that was a very, very short novel and a very short idea. And I hadn't finished with the character, as it were. So the voice was sort of ready-made, came out in a real burst, because I just wanted to sort of actually see what lay beneath the sort of, you know, the voice. So I sort of had a kind of ready-made voice ready. That's why it's very sort of, you know, sort of strongly sort of, you know, first person, just from his point of view, whatever. I don't know if that answers. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Where
did it come from? Where then?
I mean, that's sort of where it came from. And it was just because it was an idea of, you know, what lay behind the first book, in a way. You know, what was the backstory to it, almost. And I think it was this kind of a character. So.
I think it's a bit like Canada, that the woman in this kind of arrived in my head, and she was kind of fully fleshed out, and I knew exactly what she looked like and where she lived and what her kitchen was like and all that kind of stuff. But she kind of... she came very quickly upon me. It was when I was actually in Moscow a couple of years ago, and I was walking around Maxime Gorky's house, who designed this amazing kind of Art Deco house in Moscow. And I, when I went to it, there was no one else there. I was completely on my own, and it was kind of a bit spooky. And you're walking around this house that looked like someone lived there, and it was all kind of, you know, it was all exactly as though someone had just walked out of the room. And I walked past, and I suddenly caught sight of someone. And I looked at it, and it was actually a mirror, and it was me in the mirror, and it gave me a real fright, because I kind of thought, what am I doing there? And somehow that kind of scene, and it was the first scene I wrote in the book, where this woman looks in a mirror and is shocked to see herself, that she thinks she should be seeing someone else. And so she kind of arrived in that moment. I went rushing back to my youth hostel and wrote this thing down, and she was just kind of there, like I've known her all my life, really.
Are there any other questions? Somebody... move the hand up there, yeah.
About the word of models with private readers, people who read your stuff before other people read it, almost teaching situations. I mean, have either of you been to classes this way? And I'm just thinking, obviously, in this situation where both of you, one way or another, are going to be doing some teaching, but then you'd be on the other side of that.
I've been to poetry workshops for years and years, ever since I was a student, actually. Recently I haven't, because I haven't been writing any poetry. I've never been to fiction workshops, but certainly when I think I've wrote about 87 drafts in my book, and different people read them at different stages and told me to chuck bits out, and other people told me to keep those bits in and chuck other bits out. So. And no, certainly it's absolutely invaluable. I couldn't have written it. There are several people which I couldn't have written it without, and it would have been terrible. Actually, all much worse than it is anyway, without those people's comment. So I couldn't ever be the kind of isolated writer in a garret, not showing anybody my manuscript, I don't think.
That's a really good question. I genuinely don't know the answer because and I often try to think about, you know, what would be your imagination. I suppose in a way it's yourself, but then I wouldn't want to read that book. So, you know, what does that mean? You know, I wouldn't buy that book in a million years. I would take one look at it and I would never buy it. You know, you want a bad time, read this novel. So, so I mean, that's really, you know, and I won't do that again. You know.
But
just been having revelations about it being a good idea to write books that people might want to read, you know.
But speaking about readers, I mean, I remember when I was writing my first novel, it never really occurred to me that anybody was going to read it, and I would, and that's why I had all these nasty jokes in it, because they were so funny to me. And then the terrible moment when my great aunt Mary came to see me and said that she'd read everything, especially the sex scenes and so on. Were there any readers that you got that you hadn't been looking for?
I was dreading my mother reading it, certainly.
Yeah.
In fact, which is why, because in the book, the girl has a really a terrible relationship with her mother, and they row and argue the whole way through. And I had to put in at the beginning, because my mother was so upset by this, even though she knew it wasn't her, she said that everybody else would think it was her. So I had to put a thing at the beginning saying, this isn't my mother, really. And she was very shocked by a scene where someone gives a blowjob, which I she mentioned it, and I couldn't talk about it. I just said, I can't talk about blowjobs to you, I'm sorry. So yeah, certainly that was a
yes, I think surprise. The books should come with little white veils to put over certain scenes.
Yeah, exactly. You should be able to draw a curtain across things, saying, don't look, mum.
How about you? Were there any...
With this, I remember with my first one, I had a letter from somebody who's a sort of very vague friend of a, you know, thousand friends, whatever, you know, way back, but a woman who's about sort of nearly 90, who I would never have expected to like it, but there's a very old, one of the characters is sort of 80 or something like this, in the first one, and she sort of just wrote a beautiful letter about, but particularly, you know, why she liked it, because, you know, her husband died about 30 years before, and so she wrote this sort of thing about, you know, and that was very unexpected, but she did sort of put in, you know, how she found the sort of some parts of it rather exhausting. Ah. So I imagine she was referring to, but I don't know.
Yes,
but, you know, that sort of reader, you know,
yeah.
That's quite...
Yeah. Any other questions out there? Yes?
This question comes up. Writing Alan Mann, did you have to let him pick them? Did you find any possibility in men having started to stay by the
book?
Yes, it was about writing from the male point of view, and did any men get angry? Is that a less eloquent version of your question?
I think, I mean, this is actually, and this is a really good question, because I think one of the, one of the problems is, because I've given a, you know, because in writing this, you know, as a woman, well, I've given a voice to somebody who I just dislike intensely. You know, that's probably an error in the long run, but, you know. So quite a few reviewers, I think, assumed that that I was pro him, because, you know, he's probably got the better half in a way. It's, I don't know, more happens. It's a bit more kind of, you know, a bit more of a role somehow. And I think they probably assumed that meant that I was pro him, also because the book starts with his voice and then it goes to the woman's voice afterwards. And so it was very strange actually to see some men's reactions, because some sort of said, oh, somebody reviewed it, you know, very nicely, but then sort of said that they thought it was some sort of, you know, a big man bashing book, incidentally. So the people very much did actually pick up on, you know, what I thought about men or women, and so they did, yeah, it's quite an odd.
And nobody took personal offence?
Yeah, nobody took personal offence, yeah. But I think in some ways that was the strangest thing, because I think the male voice is, you know, is so the dominant one in that kind of writing. I think people just thought that I was just doing that pro this voice. You know, some people I think really thought that.
Yeah, there is something terrible that does happen sometimes, in which you write a very convincing character of the other sex, and then later on you meet them in real life.
Yeah, yes. I think that character does exist.
Yeah,
in literature, I think. Yeah,
the monsters in the everyday.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Can I ask you just a little bit about what the novels with the splendid new titles that have been endorsed by all of us here. What are they about?
My new novel's a ghost story. It's about a woman who's haunted by her boyfriend's previous girlfriend. I've become quite interested in the idea because I think these days, especially these days, people have ex-husbands and ex-boyfriends and ex-girlfriends, and you have kind of serial relationships rather than getting married and settling down at 18 or whatever. And so I'm quite interested in the relationship people have with their partner's exes. It's a kind of non-relationship, it's like a kind of photo-negative of relationship, and I think it does kind of exist, and it's sort of an interesting area, so that's what I've been thinking about.
mine is kind of it's three people. It's to do with I suppose it's almost got similarities, but it's to do with an old lover returning to see a now married woman. But it's very much to do with secrets, and it's set partly in Bali, and it's to do with pretty much Eastern versus Western philosophy, pretty much. So it's quite got a big bit of an ambitious scope.
And what was the biggest jump that you each made with the new book? You always leave something behind, something you never want to do again. You left that character behind.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Yeah, all of that manipulation of fiction, reality. Now I've sort of moved on to sort of manipulation of real life, I suppose, in the sense of the lies and secrets and so on.
Yeah.
I wanted to write a very kind of tight sort of temporal narrative because I'd kind of gone all over the place with different people and different characters and different time, and so I found it very hard actually. I had to write in a linear fashion, which was good exercise, really good discipline.
Any other questions before we draw to a close? No? Anyway, well, thank you both for coming, and come back and read for the next ones.
Thanks.
Good night. Thanks for coming.
Nice question.